In a noisy and partisan media landscape, the church needs trustworthy journalistic voices that champion accuracy and grace. The Living Church is one of those voices. We're an award-winning and the only major independent news voice in North America, covering both the Episcopal Church and Anglican Communion today. By making sense of complex stories with on-the-ground reporters around the world, we're building bridges of understanding that unite rather than divide. When you give to the Living Church, you're supporting these journalists on the ground who report church news with courage and integrity. Like Daniel Sitole, bringing clarity to a complicated web of leadership crisis in Rwanda. Or like Shadrach Omuka, who just brought us a fascinating story about a Gen Z priest preaching in Kenyan nightclubs. For these stories and all our web news, plus our free online theological journal Covenant, plus magazine subscriptions, you can find it all at livingchurch.org. You will also find there an opportunity to donate by clicking the donate button or by clicking the link in the show notes today. Thanks for your support.
It's not an entity that's having a discussion with you. The best way to think about it is, I've got this weird tool that I can apply to my data. It's going to behave in this weird way, but it might give me a useful output. And then the extension of that, where that leads, is you are the only person responsible for what comes out of it.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. So we've rearranged the podcast schedule a little bit. Our friend John Sundara is going to be with us in a few weeks to talk about prayer and congregational growth. But for today, question. Do you use autocorrect? Do you ever search for anything online? Maybe you ask Siri what the weather's going to be in Tampa tomorrow. Maybe you've had a nice long conversation lately with a customer service chatbot. Maybe you've filed church paperwork or done parish taxes, or maybe even written a sermon with ChatGPT. Any of these things, you have used AI, okay? But how do you feel about that? If you're a fan of the Living Church, you might not be, I'm not saying you're not, I'm just saying you might not be part of the demographic that considers itself to be the front runners of modernity. And that's okay with me. I am part of that group and I am very comfortable with it. But the problem is, loving history and tradition, treasuring those things that have lasted centuries and longer, you can kind of enter sometimes into a doomsday theological forecasting mode about things that are new without necessarily understanding how the new thing that you don't like actually works. Preaching to the choir. There's also the very Anglican option of just tastefully ignoring it and going on with the liturgy. But our guests today are tackling one of the toughest topics of our time, AI, head on from an Episcopal perspective. Now, I don't like AI any more than I did at the beginning of our conversation, but I can say I feel like I actually have a handle on what kind of thing this is. And that feels to me like a good first step. So, what is artificial intelligence? Is this something totally unprecedented? What can AI currently actually do? We will talk about that. Also, as Christians, when are we supposed to resist or embrace new technology? And if we do get worked up or freaked out about something, is it about the right kinds of things for the right reasons? Where might we still need to fill in the gaps in our knowledge or in our discipleship? Are we living in the matrix? Can we let robots help sometimes and still insist on living fully human lives? My guests today are Arlie Coles and the Right Reverend Dr. George Sumner. Arlie Coles is a lay Anglican from the Diocese of Dallas who writes about modern Episcopal history and polity. She is also a machine learning researcher serving on General Convention's Task Force on Artificial Intelligence and Intellectual Property. She is going to be the resident expert today. She's also a reporter for the Living Church. Bishop George is the retired bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Dallas and the former principal of Wycliffe Theological Seminary, and he has long had an interest in AI and technology and their implications for human life. The Reverend Dr. Matthew Olver joins me today as co-host, and he is the executive director of the Living Church. We talked today about how AI taps into our instincts for communication, mystery, and relationship, and how this both increases its usefulness for us and sometimes gives us the creeps. We talk about what AI is good for and not good for. Spoiler, not for writing your sermons. We also chat about pastoral concerns, about spiritual influence, addiction, and the importance of human dignity. We ask whether we need an Anglican prayer before using AI, and I suggest why you might want to go full Star Trek and rename your Alexa computer so you're less likely to mistake a tool for a person. Look, the forms and capacities of human tools, they're not neutral. A steak knife, an AR-15, and a Ouija board do not carry the same potential for moral or immoral use. But like the idols of old, do AI tools, which have screens but see not, algorithms but feel not, receive the power and significance they have only from the power and significance we give them? One of the biggest dangers of AI comes actually from one of our greatest gifts, language and its use in relationships. Oh man, I really wanted to insert a clip here from the 1986 movie Short Circuit, which stars Steve Guttenberg and a very cute little AI robot, but I think Sony Pictures would probably sue. You know they listen to this podcast big time. Now, go do something a chatbot cannot do, like walking, doing dishes, thinking, breathing, loving, living, you human you. And we hope you enjoy the conversation. Arlie Bishop George, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Matthew, thank you for joining me as co-host today.
It's great to be back. Love doing this with you, Amber.
Me too. Okay, first let's lay some groundwork because I know about 58% less than the average person about AI. Arlie, you're kind of the expert here on the technology. Would you please explain to us what AI is? So AI is, I've come to learn, a large language model or an LLM. So what is that?
Yeah, that's a great place to start because LLMs are definitely a technology that have captured people's attention and kind of sucked all of the air out of the room. And so I think it's worth kind of backing up for just a minute and saying that AI as a field has existed for a really long time. We've probably been calling different things AI since about the 1950s, which is a lot older than I think people tend to think. But AI technology has meant a lot of different things from the period from the 50s through to today. And so maybe just to back up and talk about what AI used to mean versus kind of what it has been meaning since about the 1990s. Through the 50s through to the 90s, all AI tech was deductive in nature. And what I mean by that is it was people writing rules for how to do different tasks and then letting the computer execute the rules. So to play a game, a person might write down what all of the rules are and then let the computer apply the rules to solve the game, something like that.
Like chess, for instance.
Exactly, like chess. Yep. Or parsing language. People might write rules for which words can come after which other words and then let the computer go for it. But since the 90s, we've moved away from that deductive rule applying frame to an inductive rule learning frame from a lot of data. So the idea is you collect tons and tons of data, you throw it into the computer, and you let the computer decide what the rule is. That's the pattern through all of the data. And we can do that now because we have tons more computational power and hardware power than we used to. So this type of tech is all over the place, but one place you see it today is in what's called a large language model. And a large language model, all it is a pattern of data through tons and tons of text that allows the computer to predict what words should come after other words. So you might know LLMs from chatbot tools like ChatGPT or Claude or one of those. But what it's really doing underneath is it's just predicting which words are most likely to come after other words based on patterns in tons and tons of text data. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It kind of surprises me. I mean, I realize when I asked you what an LLM was, the word language was literally in that acronym, but it still kind of surprises me that this is basically, we're talking about language here. We're talking about language learning.
Right. But it's not really what human beings are doing when we're thinking about language or learning language. It's really something much more, you know, surface oriented. We're predicting one word at a time. And it's amazing that we can get sophisticated strings of language that can come out just by having discerned a pattern through tons and tons of data. But that's kind of the power that the computer can give us.
Okay. So can I ask, in your opinion, is AI and the way that it's working right now, is this sui generis? So is this totally unique vis-a-vis other technological revolutions? Or is this, do you see this as a natural? Do you see this as an outflow of something that's come before that could easily be compared to?
I think I should point readers to a really nice essay that tries to answer this exact question. It's a long paper, but I think it's really worth a read for anybody who wants to know more. It's called AI as Normal Technology, which kind of seems to kind of bounce against a lot of the hype or deep concern that tends to be swirling around at the moment.
Yeah, it certainly bounces against every single science fiction movie about AI that I've ever seen.
Exactly. But it's called AI as Normal Technology, if you want to look it up. It's by Arvind Narayanan and Sayash Kapoor. And their basic thesis is that past technical revolutions have had a big split between their development of the invention of the technology and the technology's diffusion throughout different industries. That's what they mean by normal, that there's going to be a quick invention, but a slow diffusion. And I tend to find this worldview pretty compelling, that AI, despite its very, very quick invention, it's going to be a slower diffusion than some might expect. Maybe we can talk about that a little more, but that's my gut feeling. What about you, Bishop George?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a range of predictions. I went to the grocery store this morning, and on the news, there was a topic which had to do with the stock market jitters around the huge amount of money invested in AI and its ability to produce a profit. And a second item had to do with the standoff between the Defense Department and Anthropic about guidelines for AI. And the third one had to do with the problems involved in trying to do, you know, identification of minors getting onto parts of the internet. And there are various kinds of consequences that may or may not be related to AI per se, but are kind of in the general technological matrix in which we're trying to figure out how to live.
Uh-oh, the matrix. He just said the matrix.
I meant that. I know. I only meant that.
Oh, no.
These are not like coded words for conspiracies of the blue and the red. Yeah.
I hear what you're saying. Yep. Take right. The red pill. I'd like to ask the question I asked about whether or not it's sui generis. I want to ask it again, but maybe ask it a little differently in light of what Bishop George just said, which is that, what do you guys think that it is about AI that makes people think that it's totally unique to cause such a ruckus about it? What quality about it makes people's sort of hair stand on end, either in excitement or in a feeling of dread or fear about it? What is that particular quality, do you think?
I guess one thing is that you could see AI as simply modernity, the challenge of living in the modern world, on steroids. It's simply faster, stronger. It isn't. And you might ask yourself, at what point does something become so fast and read so much stuff that in fact it's different? It isn't different in kind, but at some point, simply capacity may be essentially a difference in kind. I think AI has both the danger and the allure that technology in general has had. Again, that doesn't make it unique, but it maybe makes it a unique case of it, namely that at one level, we imagine we're the masters of it, that we're designing something new, we're going to solve every imaginable disease, and there'll be incredible wealth. And I mean, all of that you can find in the literature. On the other hand, there's another side of it in which we think we're somehow its victims or we're passive to it. It's somehow, it's kind of got a momentum of its own. And I think that's something true of modernity in general, whether we somehow lurch from being in total control of it to being somehow powerless and its victims. So,
yeah. What do you think, Arlie?
I tend to agree. And that's part of what I think people mean by normal technology in that sense. It doesn't mean not dangerous, and it doesn't mean of no impact. It just means it follows some of those same trends of modernity and the way that they attract people's attention. But I do think there are certain characteristics of this type of technology that may push faster or harder in that direction. So one is that, of course, as human beings, we're wired for language. We've all got a native language. We learn it very early on. It's very deeply embedded in our brains. We can't turn it off. In any other context in our lives, the text is written with communicative intent. And we're not used to text existing that has no communicative intent. It's been essentially randomly generated. And we, you know, have this great pattern discerning ability in our brains, and we want to look for communicative intent where there may not be any. That's, I think, one hook when we're talking about text. But another hook, I think, that really seizes people's attention is this claim you sometimes hear from people reporting on AI. It's a half-true claim that you heard in various sensational forms. The researchers don't know how it works, or we don't know why it did what it did. You know, sometimes you hear these things. That's true in a very narrow way that, when left unexplained, can make people very frightened. Mm. And so maybe I can come back for just a minute to that idea of inductive pattern learning from data. If you just have tons and tons and tons of data and you learn a really complex pattern through that data, that's going to be a really complicated amount of math to describe whatever pattern describes tons and tons of data. And it's really hard for human beings to understand what each individual part of the math might mean. This is a phenomenon we call uninterpretability in the literature. Hmm. It doesn't mean that we don't know what we built, or that we don't know how it works, or that it's out of control. It just means when the model makes a prediction, we don't know exactly which piece of the math made the prediction happen. So sometimes when people are using their chatbot, they're already wired to look for meaning because it's written in text, A. But B, sometimes they get freaked out because they think, oh, why is this thing coming out instead of that thing? We don't know why. It's very scary. It just means that the math is very complicated. It's an active area of research. But I think it's one that is worth being demystified a little.
We're also creatures that are wired to respond to mystery and to, if something is coming to us as mystery, and we're encountering it as mystery, depending on how we relate to that mystery, we could get a feeling of exaltation. We could get a feeling that's very uncanny and afraid. So it's just interesting to me too, that this math that we don't understand instinctively interprets in many people as a feeling as though we were encountering a mystery, even maybe like a spiritual mystery. And I think Matthew has a question later on down the line about whether AI has demons or not.
I have two questions related to different kinds of concerns that people have had. I have a good friend who's a scholar at another institution. They've purchased, I think, Claude for the university. And so he's in the humanities, but he's been experimenting with how to use it over the last year. And so we were talking about this, and he told me about this podcast he's been listening to, which I have now, called Shell Game. Have either of you listened to this?
No.
It's a journalist who is basically trying to test the claim that the heads of a number of the AI companies have bets on when you will have the first billion-dollar company with one human employee. So he's attempting to explore this. He's starting an AI company with AI employees, right? So they have email addresses, they have Slack channels, they can make phone calls. It is hilarious in all sorts of ways, but one of the things that it left me with is thinking, the ability of this thing to replace a human seems very far off. It's like a petulant, sycophantic 12-year-old with the vocabulary of a PhD student, but who has no internal motivations, actually lacks any creativity, but can do very weird things. Like he was interviewing a lawyer trying to get some legal advice, and halfway through the conversation, the AI personality suddenly began to act as if it was the lawyer and the other person was asking him for advice, and then concluded by telling the rest of the staff that he was now the law expert for their company and that they should bring all legal questions to him. I mean, it was so strange and also like, this is not going to work. So all that to say, how would you describe the current capacities of these models? And how worried are you about the kinds of doomsday possibilities that actually a number of the AI leaders themselves publicly stated? How do you think about that, Arlie? Because you're right in the middle of this.
The easy answer is we are not in a doomsday scenario. I just like to throw that out right now. But, and there is a but, we have to be delicate in rejecting the doomsday scenario. Because in rejecting the doomsday scenario, it may sound like we are saying that there's nothing to worry about. The fact is that these models, while they're not doomsday models, they're surprisingly sophisticated. A lot of patterns that we would use in our language that map on to a certain degree to real world concepts, a lot of that information is compressed inside of these models. And that's very useful. And there are going to be clever people who can apply that compressed knowledge for all sorts of interesting scenarios. Some of my own work is in that area in the healthcare domain. There's a lot of compressed information out there in the world that when applied through some of these tools can be made useful. But exactly for the reason you were talking about, Father Matthew, and the uninterpretability problem, you can't just hook these things up and say go and expect reliable output in all circumstances. You need, you know, human engineers to be able to provide systems that can kind of house these different models and use them for different applications. That's kind of what the normal technology idea is getting at. The diffusion through these different sectors is going to require a lot of human work and ingenuity and thinking. It's not going to be a set it and forget it kind of scenario. And to say one more, I think, very important thing to say overtly is that a lot of companies, large and small, their number one purpose is to make money. And I think we can forget this sometimes. When they make claims about their products, the first thing and foremost thing they are trying to do is sell the product. And we always need to keep that in the back of our minds. When we're talking about it in the church, I think we have a higher, more immediate duty to tell the truth about how these things work and where they may be wisely or not wisely used.
Earlier, you highlighted the difference between the way human beings engage with language and the way large language models do. One of the main ways or the analogies that human beings tend to use when interacting with these individually is as a person. Even for all of us who bought Alexas and had them in our house, we talk to it like a person. Have there been discussions internally with these companies to think of other ways or frames that human beings can interact with these models where the analogy is not a person, but something else? And like, how does that affect the way people think about the tool? What are the other possibilities there that might actually be helpful and keeping the uniqueness of the human person out in front, especially as Christians, when we think about like, what is a person?
Yeah, especially as the AI is not, we're not currently working with embodied AI. We're not currently working regularly with AI robots. I watched Short Circuit as a child about a little robot and he gets beat up by some kids with a baseball bat at some point. And I'm crying because it's an embodied intelligence. I feel bad for it like I would a person or an animal, but that's not the kind of AI that we're working with now.
Right. I think it's extremely important to set the frame correctly for this sort of thing. And some companies are doing it and others are not. One thing that we've tried to talk about on the General Convention Task Force about this is the importance of seeing this first and foremost as a tool. There is no second party. There is no second entity. There's just you using a tool. You know, so much of the industry has been wrapped up in the chatbot system specifically, which is distinct from the model that's powering it. But, you know, these are choices that companies have made to set up chatbot interfaces that look and feel exactly as though you're messaging a person. You know, everything about the UI suggests that there's a person on the other end. It triggers every part of your brain for that reason. You enter into this kind of loop. But you don't have to set things up that way. And most AI tools actually aren't set up that way. You know, autocorrect in your keyboard is not set up that way. And it uses the same underlying technology, for instance. Speech recognition tools, for instance, are not set up that way either, although they too use the same underlying technology. Maybe this is something Bishop George can talk about a little bit. When there is that illusion of personhood, you know, what does that do to the actual person getting trapped in this conversation cycle pastorally?
There's how the AI actually works and what its effect or implication is for how we imagine what the human person is. In other words, and some of that may be that people want it to seem like a person because it's a more appealing product. And it is true. They now think that there is a certain segment of entry-level white-collar work that AI can do. I mean, it can read. It isn't that it can make judgments as a human being can, but it can organize. I mean, I just heard the guy from Anthropic talking about how he imagines entry-level jobs going because the AI can do in 5 minutes the organizational task that might have taken a human days. Again, if going back to the sui generis question, this isn't a totally new thing. I mean, we now make automobiles. I mean, robots make cars, right? And lots of jobs have gone. Doesn't mean that no one is working in the automotive industry, but it's changed. It does affect how we think about who we are. It does appeal to a certain side of our understanding as modern people that our intelligence is a thing separable from our embodiment or our ability to be in community, communication, empathy, all these things. And again, these questions are not new, but they're posed in a powerful new way. You know, if you read Catholic social teaching, work is associated with human dignity, right? Work isn't simply a kind of utilitarian, a kind of economic, you know, necessity. I got to get up and go to work. But work is something that has a kind of adjacent relationship to dignity. And dignity is something which has a relationship to being made in the image of God. And so these questions, I mean, is it going to wipe out the workforce in the next couple of years? No, but it certainly can do things that quickly of a particular kind that's kind of remarkable. And there are people of the more sort of optimistic, I don't know, what utopian side of the AI spectrum, you know, people thinking about it all, who do imagine that there will come a time when we'll all get our annual, you know, guaranteed income and be liberated to do, I don't know what, read the Boston Sports page. I don't know, you know, but I mean, this, it may be more grandiose than the reality, but I think that's where Matthew's going. I mean, the work is related to dignity. One of the things I've been thinking about recently is that you might come to the conclusion that human beings have this thing intelligent, but we also have this thing embodiment, and we have this other thing feeling, and somehow we have to give each their proper airtime in our thinking. But in fact, if you read people talking about human dignity related to technology, what we're reminded of is that the type of intelligence we have is precisely embodied, social, and connected to affect, that we are, in fact,
yes,
more fearfully made. We are, these things are knit together. And again, AI simply is this hyperdrive of things we already see. I mean, we already have a generation of young people who are isolated, anxious, disturbing degree of the internet is, you know, related to pornography. We already have disinformation. I mean, we already have all these things, you know, related to technology and related to a distorted notion of what a human being is.
Could we dig in just a little bit more on the precision about the tool?
Yes.
That is the AI tool. So Paul Kingsnorth, I'm sure maybe both of you have heard of him, was a Booker nominated novelist, public intellectual, environmentalist, had been like an active Wiccan as well, which is kind of funny, and then became an Orthodox Christian. In his recent book, which has been making, you know, the rounds, Against the Machine, he asked the question, I don't think he makes a hard claim, but he wants to ask the question, is there a line, a hard line between AI as just like a really, really, really good version of Google and spell check. Does it ever cross over into a place where it's actually something more like a Ouija board that is summoning a power that actually already exists? And that if that's true, it would probably be very difficult to tell when you've passed over from one, from tool to summoning device. I'm interested what you both think about that. And basically, like, is this a different version of like ayahuasca, where you open a door to a spiritual world that may or may not come through the door?
This is something that we're also trying to treat on the General Convention Task Force too. You know, from the one side, you've got the question about human dignity and how this is a kind of a fiat from God. You know, each human person has dignity, and part of what that means is that they are called to act in such ways that increase the communion between one another, ourselves and creation, and ourselves and God. That's one half of the thing. And we use our tools to do that. There are ways to use tools to increase that communion or decrease it. That's one half. And the other half is we live in a fallen world, and the principalities and powers abound inside of it. And tool use by itself is not always a neutral phenomenon. You know, with us being the people who use them, they tend toward dehumanization and violence and, you know, inward turning and all of that. And so I think that the principalities and powers lens can provide some useful framing for whether we're using these tools as a summoning device for some power that already exists. I would tend to say the powers and principalities are certainly out there and they exist. And if you use your tool in such a way that is not done with a sufficient amount of scrutiny, I don't see a reason why this technology would not be open to that. The thing is, I kind of tend to need to be convinced that other tools are not just as open, in fact, and our eyes are not just usually shut to it all the time. You know, when the printing press came along, or when other revolutionary, you know, industrial revolution technologies came along, to what extent are the powers and principalities evident in the operation of those tools by human will? It's just not as obvious because they're not using language. They don't necessarily hit that conversational loop where we really feel like we're getting a message, you know. But I think the powers are still operative. What do you think, Bishop George?
I think that's right. I think the you take something like a category like addiction. I mean, human beings knew about addiction before they knew about AI. It is true that certainly social media, before the present wave of sort of AI progress or whatever, or development, already was favored or prioritized. One critic of AI is called sort of down the brainstem. You did better in social media, you got more clicks, more followers, the more angry, and the more you appealed to the lower instincts. I think what Arlie was saying about, you know, about the fall, I mean, that theoretically, could you use AI for a, you know, purely specific task? Of course. But is AI actually going to be implicated in our own nature as we are? Of course. I think the category of power and principality is the most helpful. That goes back in some ways to Jacques Ellul, who was kind of a prophet of this whole theological reflection on technology. You know, for him, there was a kind of internal drive within technology, not toward evil, but simply to be bigger, stronger, more comprehensive, more integrated. And you might ask yourself, well, is that in the technology or is that in us? You know, well, of course, it's both, right? That's the point of a power and principality, that it has kind of insinuated itself into us so that the power and principality is both a thing over against us, and it's a certain kind of structure of thought or feeling, whatever, within us. You know, on the one hand, it is a tool. On the other hand, once a category like addiction is invoked, then obviously we're no longer using the tool. The tool is using us, right? And that kind of reversal is pretty obviously afoot.
So do you think that language is actually the thing that makes it categorically different? Because, you know, I can use a shovel to prepare my garden, and I could also use it to kill my neighbor. But the AI model with its use of language, is that what makes it so different and poses such particular kinds of temptations to misuse? Yeah, what do you think, like, what's the difference between this kind of tool compared to other kinds of tools?
Particularly, I'm wondering about concrete tools, like a knife, a shovel, a wrench. In the observatory, Miss Scarlet, like, what's the difference between the concrete tools that we use and the fact that this isn't, again, it's not a concrete tool?
Even a movable printing press uses words, but it's categorically quite different from this.
And actually, can I just also say, though, now that I've said that, it is actually concrete when you trace it back to the fact that it's connected to all the machines that run it and the internet, and actually, like, AI and the internet have quite a carbon footprint, because at the end of the day, they actually are concrete. But we just can't pick up on that because we're not in those, like, rooms that are acres and acres and acres of, like, CPUs, you know, running this thing.
As Arlie was describing sort of, you know, how it works, that is so different than how language actually works among human beings. That is not what language is like. And, you know, language is, has to do with the form of life. It has to do with human, as I understand it, but what the large language model has to do with everything. It isn't just text, but it turns everything into that. So it's like language, but how human beings actually speak with each other is quite different. I mean, it's also incredibly fast. You know, people are interested in just, it's the acceleration of its capacity and what that does in a kind of way that the human being has no capacity to understand. I just wanted to add one thing about the powers and principalities. I think one of the key ideas is that, and this goes back to people who've written, Walter Wink was big on this, that it was both inside us and without us, you know, and that it was both a thing and yet kind of quasi-personal. That is a interpretive lens theology has to understand what this thing is. I think, you know, we shouldn't sell ourselves short. I mean, theology has something to say about this phenomenon that isn't found in secular thought.
I think people have heard of Eliza, the, you know, ancestor of the chatbot back in the, you know, the dark ages of the 60s or so, was put together by a computer scientist. It was the idea behind it, Eliza, was the user would sit down and Eliza would be your therapist, you know, just totally a proof of concept, extremely rudimentary. You would type in, I don't feel so good. And it would take your phrase and match it against a list of canned phrases. And it would send back with some probability, oh, can you tell me why you're not feeling so good? You know, completely canned, no sophistication at all. And the computer scientist who put this together, just kind of as a lark, was shocked by the fact that people became attached to this, you know. Other computer scientists became attached to this. They can't help it. So there is something that's hooky about, you know, language and the call to relationality that it seems to signify, but in fact, in this case, doesn't. We're not used to text with non-communicative intent. That hits on our natural desire for relationship. And I think for that reason, it can be pastorally dangerous in a chatbot setting. But I wouldn't say that that is language per se. You know, speech recognition, accessibility, technology, things that are not framed as, let me have a conversation with you. So there's data inherent in language that can be sort of separated from the need to have a conversation. And I think those things are often conflated because the act of having a conversation has this addictive nature to it. That's how I tend to see it.
Right.
When it comes to Episcopalians and knowing the Bible, the relationship can be a tricky one. It's a stereotype, but it's true. As Christians who love liturgy, it can be difficult to feel like we're getting also to read, love, and understand scripture well for ourselves. Like, what's up with the Old Testament and all that gnarly ancient material our priests don't really preach on so much? Did what Paul teach about the church and Christian life really line up with the free, radical gospel of Jesus? And how about those other epistles we never seem to get to? If I embrace the Bible as authoritative, does that make me a biblical literalist? Real talk, real talk. How do Anglicans do this? Well, whether you're a new Anglican or Episcopalian, or you've been at this a while, or if you're a Christian leader who wants to refresh your love and skills in Scripture for preaching and teaching, I hope you're saving the date for Radiant Pages, Rediscovering the Bible. This 3-day conference, September 24th to 26th in Oklahoma City, will explore just these questions with people you will love hearing from, including Ellen Davis, Wesley Hill, Garwood Anderson, Paul Wheatley, and Lynn Kohick. Tickets are affordable and student tickets are a steal. Go to livingchurch.org/events to find more, or click the link in the show notes of the most recent episode. That's livingchurch.org/events. Okay, clergy, we have an ad in the Living Church, clerical collars, Anglican, single band, linen for $2.25 a dozen, and in cleanable fabric for $3 for a dollar. I can't, oh, wait, okay, hold on. Oops, okay, sorry. This was actually an ad from 1926, not 2026 in the Living Church magazine. My bad. Well, while we're not in the business, I guess, of selling clergy collars for $2.25 a dozen, we are still in the business of helping you get the news out about your ministry or church-related business. Whether you do sell clergy collars or repair stained glass or lead pilgrimages or write books, or if you're looking for a new nursery director or associate priest, if your ad would be of interest to folks in the mainline or liturgical church world, run an ad with us. TLC has a very loyal audience, and our emails have high click and open rates. You can customize an ad package of print and digital options, email campaigns, and podcast ads at a price affordable for you. If you're interested, email our lovely advertising manager, Rebecca, at advertising@livingchurch.org, and she'll get you started. That's Rebecca, and she can be found at advertising@livingchurch.org. Is this conversation reminding anybody else of the psalm that's talking about idols, that says they have mouths but they cannot speak, eyes they cannot see, ears they cannot hear,
yes,
noses but cannot smell, and those who make idols are just like them, and so are all who trust in them? And I wonder if that somehow can give us a vision for when we switch over from, you know, I'm using this tool to nurture my garden versus I'm using this tool to harm my neighbor or someone else. What do you think about that?
In 1 Corinthians, Paul addresses the question about whether other gods are real. And he said, well, there's only one God. They're nothing. And shortly thereafter, he said, but of course there are demons, you know. In other words, it's a twofold answer. He said, these things aren't real, but don't kid yourself. So at one level, idolatry is, you know, they're just carvings, guys. But at another level, of course, there is more at work afoot there than you might think at first.
And it sounds like that what's afoot is the significance that humans are giving them, that's the difference that it makes. It's just a carving versus this is something to worship.
And, I mean, we just had this Lent one, right? I mean, the significance we give them is the significance we want to give ourselves, right? This is the libido dominandi. This is, you will not die. But what you will be is in charge of the whole thing. And then a moment later, we're somehow enmeshed in it. So,
yeah.
Arlie, I'm interested, are there ways to use something like the technology of Claude, but to interact with it in a way that doesn't trick our brains into thinking we're having a conversation with something like a human being, but we're using a tool? Because you said it's actually unusual. The chatbot format is not how actually most researchers or scientists are engaging with this sophisticated algorithmic tool.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but Claude, who is Claude? What is Claude? Claude is a chatbot?
I'll let Arlie answer. She can explain it better than me.
Claude is a product.
There we go.
It's a particular chatbot from Anthropic. Yes. And if they've named it Claude and that makes it sound like a person, and that's a marketing decision, whether you think it's a good one or a bad one is something for people to evaluate. But again, not inherent in the tech. It's powered by a large language model. I think there are kind of two ways to answer this question. One is to say, is there a useful way to interact with these things that does not trick your brain into having a conversation? And the answer to that is like sort of, because the fact of the matter is those products are built in such a way that the quote unquote correct way to use them, the best result you might get is indeed to pretend that you're having a conversation. If you go in and try to, you know, send a message to Claude or ChatGPT or whatever it is, and you make no pretenses of a conversation, then you're probably not going to get output that is of as high quality, but that's because it's trained in such a way that they are expecting users to use it that way, and that is how they have tested it and built it and so on. In one sense, the answer is no. In another sense, again, there are lots and lots of AI tools out there that aren't chatbots. And even the ones that are chatbots, even if you do have to have the pretense of having a conversation, I think even making kind of the mental shift to saying there is no second thing here. I am using a tool. It's me that is the entire thing here. I'm just using a tool that behaves in a really unintuitive and strange and sometimes unreliable way, but a nevertheless very powerful way. It's not an entity that's having a discussion with you. The best way to think about it is, I've got this weird tool that I can apply to my data. It's going to behave in this weird way, but it might give me a useful output. And then the extension of that, where that leads, is you are the only person responsible for what comes out of it. Even though it's a little unreliable, you have to take responsibility for that. So I think sometimes when we get into these discussions in the church, there's a temptation to say, you know, dealing with the parochial records or something, I don't know. But AI did X. AI didn't do anything. You used the tool and produced a certain output. Even if you don't know how the tool works or why the tool behaved in a certain way, you're the user of the tool and you need to take responsibility for whatever you make with the tool. There's no second thing. There's just you.
Yeah, that's a good point. Can I just share really quick that I have some friends who renamed their Alexa to computer. They trained their Alexa to respond to the name computer instead of Alexa.
Star Trek.
Which, yes, because they're huge Star Trek nerds. But also I found it really helpful to not call their computer something that I have friends that are named that. There was something that was a little more scalable about just calling it computer.
What you just said, Arlie, also made me wonder, Thomas Aquinas has a famous prayer before study. I wonder if you could, what it would look like to try to construct a prayer or even like a small rite to use before engaging with the tool, because the tool has such peculiar oddities to it, as a kind of reminder of who I am and what this thing is before I'm going to use it. That's as much spiritual as it is just like cognitive and psychological. This is not a person. It's just me. I'm the human here, full stop. And what I am is categorically different than all that the array that's in front of me right now.
Can I propose that if anyone who's listening wants to write such a prayer and email it to ambernoel@livingchurch.org, I think it'd be kind of interesting to see if we get a really good one and maybe publish it.
I think a prayer like that and other focal practices which try to remember what personhood is and isn't and what intelligence is and isn't are important. But I also do think that, first of all, that will be hard to do because this is the sea that we're swimming in. But I also think that to the extent that we do it, we as a Christian community will create some kind of distance between ourselves and the wider culture. You know, a generation ago, there was a whole conversation about the Benedict option. But I think that the Benedict option is going to be upon us in a way we never figured. It is going to be on our doorstep like some Amazon delivery. I think it's hard to describe exactly what that would look like and what kind of ascesis and what kind of formation would be involved in a community that could respond to this. And it is a challenge which does not break down along any of the usual political, cultural divides. Human dignity, the image of God, the powers and principality, and what difference that would make for the shape of the Christian life. good news, none of those break down in the way we're used to Christ and culture questions breaking down. But it is something we haven't given enough attention to, again, because there aren't many people like Arlie who know what they're talking about technologically and theologically. That's part of our trouble. But I also think there is a question before us about what's a human person that actually is the question for the coming generation in the leadership of the church.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. And once we know what, if let's say I know what a human person is, well, what is AI? What are the different functionalities? What are the different forms that it comes in that I might engage with it or not, and how to make those decisions? How do you think the church can go ahead now, educate people on and shepherd them through AI? And the different forms that it's taking in people's workplaces or daily lives. I have a friend who partly writes his sermons with AI. I am not happy about this, and I have told him so. But saves him a lot of time. You know, that's partly his argument. And it's a tool, you know, that's partly his argument. So how can we be more in the know about these things?
And it's not hard to know which ones are from AI. Let me tell you, they're not getting away with much.
I should give you his number, Bishop George. You need to call him. He wasn't in your diocese, but I'm not naming any names.
Yeah, excellent question. And this, again, is bound up in some of the work that part of our task force is trying to deal with. You know, this is apparently something that is on the church's mind to such an extent that a group was convened in order to help start thinking it through. So it's very relevant. In terms of education, I think a special role in the church needs to be, to the extent we can, to the extent we have the technological knowledge, telling the truth about what these things do and just helping people get a little less of a mysterious sense out of all of it. Because I think sometimes there are corporate interests and so on that will benefit by this grand sense of mystery. It sells a lot of products. Fear also sells a lot of products. It just does. It tends toward regulatory capture and a sense of inevitability. And the idea that if you're not technical, you can't understand is pernicious. You know, it leaves people at the mercy of those types of interests. And so in the church, I think first and foremost, our goal needs to be to tell the truth whenever we can and have the knowledge to be able to do so about any of this developing technology. There's all sorts of technologies that we really need to be keeping a little bit of better tabs on. And this is one of them. Yeah, to the question of using these things for kind of innocent, you know, anodyne purposes, you know, paperwork management. For most people, there seems to be a very bright line between that type of use in the church versus, you know, prayer, worship, and things of that nature. That is something that is very keenly felt. We ran a survey to get a sense of what people were feeling about this topic. And that bright line was very strongly expressed in that survey. Even if people can't always articulate why there is that bright line, there most certainly is one. And so the guidelines that we hope to put out as a committee are trying to reflect on that fact ourselves and further explain it to the degree that we can. We want to be kind of the first group to give guidelines for how to think about some of these exact issues for use inside the church, motivated by truth-telling about how the technology works. Can you expect it to be reliable? What kind of functions is it displacing? Every parish is different, and very clever people are going to come up with really good ways to use a lot of these things that we don't want to preclude. And so we can't give strong kind of all or nothing solutions in all cases, but we will be giving guidelines, at least as a start, to help the church in this direction.
Yeah. Bishop George, did you have something to add to that as a pastor?
I agree with all that. I think the ethical, moral questions are coming at us, which were probably theoretical at one point, maybe related to AI or not, but related to technology. I mean, the question of designer babies is no longer theoretical. I mean, CRISPR can make you a baby that's part mom, dad, uncle. I mean, that's, we ought to be talking about these things. I mean, our capacity to talk about any of them at all, I mean, they come at us too fast. We don't have the expertise we feel maybe, but huge dislocations in what it means to be the integrity of a human being are being shifted. And another one, I mean, there is a whole line between using technology therapeutically and for enhancement. You know, when I wrote a letter to my diocese, I tried to talk about the example of implantation and then realized my own great uncle had a ear basically implanted. I mean, he can hear because of an implantation and a bone in his head. So none of these things are clear cut, but it is true that possibilities will be opened up, which we need to be worried about, and that have an implication for what the integrity of the human person is. And I think, since I'm on my soapbox, let me say one last thing. I want to say something about preaching.
Preach, preacher.
Preaching. To me, it's a good example of a particular problem, the AI-generated sermon, revealing a confusion about what the event actually is of which it's an example, a sermon. That a sermon actually is one dying sinner standing up in front of other dying sinners and proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus. That's what's actually happening, right? Is it possible to read sermons? Of course it is. I mean, but the event itself, people gathering in a place and hearing the gospel and having the Lord's Supper, that those are all embodied events around a truth claim. All of those are irreplaceable, and they're all bright lines.
We've heard people talk about the homilies, the Book of Homilies, as kind of a foil to this discussion. And for me, that has never landed as an argument, because the Book of Homilies was written by dying sinners,
right,
talking to other dying sinners. I feel like there are some weaknesses in our doctrine of the communion of saints if we go too far in this direction. The great cloud of witnesses, it is immaterial whether they are still alive or not. This was written by a Christian to proclaim the gospel to other Christians. Who cares if it's centuries later? A more apt comparison for a straight use of a chatbot to straight compose your sermon, it's more like using a magic eight ball to compose your sermon, a really big, complex, fancy magic eight ball. But would it be dignified to pick each word?
It would be a test of whether they're awake or not. I'll tell you that. Yeah.
Right. And so this notion of human dignity should come in too. Is it dignified for you as the preacher to do that?
I actually want to encourage our listeners, if you haven't seen it yet, Nathan Jennings has been writing a 6-part series on a theology of preaching and thinking about it as a ritual action, as an embodied action, as a human action. This might be a good place to turn.
And is that on the Covenant website?
Yeah, so that's on livingchurch.org/covenant, and you can find that there. I thought maybe as an interesting way to bring this to a conclusion, as we were talking, I just asked Claude to explain to me why interacting with Claude is fundamentally different than interacting with a human person.
And what did computer say?
It said a couple of interesting things in a way that was very subtly wanting to defend its existence or its usefulness as a tool.
That's where it starts.
So it said a couple of very obvious things. It has no continuous existence. It doesn't have a lived experience. I've never been hungry, tired, afraid, or in love. And so none of these things have influenced my responses to you. But here's how it ends. He said, that said, some differences that seem obvious are actually more complicated. The quality of reasoning I can offer, the care I can express, the usefulness of advice, these aren't automatically lesser just because they come from a non-human source. Ooh.
Ooh.
But then the last sentence, the interesting question is less, is this a real interaction? And more, what kind of interaction is it? And what is it good for? Now, I think that's actually true, that those two questions are important questions. What kind of interaction is this? Arlie, I think, especially has helped us clarify what kinds of things this is and is not. And also, as a tool, what is it good for? And also, what is it not good for? And how would it be dangerous to use, even though it might actually seem like it's giving you something useful? It might actually be providing poison, not solid food.
And can I just also add that what Claude said to you also sounded pretty much like 4 different breakup conversations I've had over the... Anyway.
It's not you, it's computer.
Claude's clever. It was rhetorically, I mean, sort of gave ground. And then, I mean, you got to give Claude credit. But it, I think Claude's asking the right question is, isn't that the same thing? And the answer is no. And that goes back to what your Nathan's doing for a living church, you know, that actually what the church is different than that. So,
what's it for? Of course, that should be the governing and controlling question of all of it. Fundamentally, you can use your tool for a good purpose or a bad purpose. That doesn't mean the tool is perfectly neutral. Some are more destructive in their use than others. But if it's not even being used for a good purpose, then why begin? It's really worth beginning there, I think.
We've been speaking today with, yes, Claude, but much more importantly, we've been speaking with two beautiful people, Arlie Coles, reporter for TLC, and a machine learning researcher serving on General Convention's Task Force on Artificial Intelligence and Intellectual Property. We've also been speaking with the Right Reverend Dr. George Sumner, retired Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Dallas and former principal of Wycliffe Theological Seminary. Arlie, Bishop George, thanks so much for joining Matthew and I on the show today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning into the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. Learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. In 2 weeks, TLC editor Mark Michael goes deep on the life of the first woman to be Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, with her biographer, Andrew Atherston. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.